Try to imagine for a moment, just a moment, our lives with just people, meaning no pets. Can you even imagine? Even if you're not currently living with a pet, you're no doubt conscious of other people's pets and the love their owners shower upon them. And it would appear some coming in the other direction. But do our dogs actually love us? That's just one of many questions raised and answered in a new book from dog researcher Alexandra Horowitz called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. Alexandra Horowitz directs the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College at Columbia University in New York. She has written several previous books and with this appearance completes the Jefferson Exchange Grand Slam with her fourth visit. Alexandra, welcome back.
It's really nice to be back. Thanks.
Always good to have you. Thank you again for teaching me the term vomeronasal. It's one of the highlights of my career.
Excellent.
So let's talk about your own journey. How much more do you know about dogs than a decade ago?
Oh, wow. You know, I was just beginning to be a scientist studying dog behavior and cognition in the early 2000s, and I think it's entirely changed how I look at dogs. You know, we're very familiar with them. We sort of think we understand everything about them, but just probe the surface a little bit, and we find that all our expectations, you know, fall aside. You know, how they see the world turns out to be different than how we see the world. So I think my knowledge has changed a lot, hopefully for the dog's benefit.
Well, lest anybody think your job is all puppy love, you describe actually quite a detachment. Tell us about the arm's length distance with subjects at the lab.
Right. I study owned dog behavior. So we basically are interested in looking at how dogs behave when we give them little puzzles, when we ask them to solve a task. And we have these dogs who come into our lab with their people, with their owners. And they stay with their owners because we don't want to make them feel anxious or anything. And as experimenters, as researchers, we really want to just greet these dogs and say hello and coo at them and tickle them just the way you would with a dog that you meet on the street or at a friend's house. But we know that the sensitivity of dogs to humans, meaning they react so strongly and effectively to everything we do, would entirely undermine what we're trying to do in the experiment. You know, if we present two plates with different quantities of substance, and we want to see which one they're more interested in, but we're sitting right behind those plates, looking and smiling at the dog, the dog's not interested in the plates. You know, the dog just comes to us. So we have to not greet the dog. We have to not pet the dog. We try not to even really look straight at the dog, and certainly in the study, we might even wear sunglasses or turn our backs. Because we just have to be uninteresting to dogs, at least for the time that they're in our study.
Wow, I didn't realize the whole thing with the sunglasses, too, but you're really just trying to be almost invisible to the dog in terms of a human being.
They're so sensitive to us, and they take such cues from us about how to behave and what to do next. So we might give inadvertent cues to them, even when we're not trying to, looking in a certain place and giving the dog an indication they should go one way rather than the other. It's kind of torture to have to do that. At the end, we can, you know, debrief with the dogs and sit down and pet them and greet them appropriately.
Okay, so it gets a little less clinical at the end, you're saying.
Yes.
So what you've just told me then explains this interesting quote in the book, that every aspect of looking closely at dog behavior has a human component. So they're really attuned to us that much.
I think this is their success, that they're so attuned to human behavior and responsive to us in just the type of way that we would expect from another person, really. You know, you say something and a person says something back, or as you're talking, they're looking at you. And those are the types of things, except for the saying something back, that a dog does. They're sensitive to us as though we were members of the same species.
Do you learn sometimes more about the owners than about the dogs in the work at the lab?
I don't intend to be studying the owners when they come into my lab, but it certainly is the case that as they bring their dogs in, the dog-human relationship is kind of the elephant in the room. I realize how much is going on between the dog and their person, and I certainly see lots of different ways that people talk to their dogs, and we are continuously talking to our dogs. I see how the dog looks to them for assurance or for instructions about what they're going to do next. You know, people really handle their dogs differently. So you wind up seeing lots of different approaches to living with dogs, yeah, inadvertently.
We'll get into what we're doing when we're talking to dogs later. It comes later in the book and later in this conversation. Naming gets a chapter in the book, though, and I love the story about some African naming conventions that you provide here. What's going on there?
Well, so naming is a really interesting topic to dive into, and I was glad to be able to do it in this book. One of the ideas of naming is that we're kind of creating a story for the dog going forward, right? We're just like with naming children, we're maybe creating the person we want them to be or hope they will be. And with a dog, we're kind of creating a personality. But in some cultures, as you mentioned, in this African cultures, dogs are named to communicate with somebody else in their villages. So in these communities, it's rude to call out somebody for doing something which you think is bad behavior. But they name their new dogs after the perceived slight that has been inflicted on them. So you might have a dog named something like, you know, if you don't pay back your debts, you know, nobody will trust you. whenever the neighbor walks by, the person deliberately calls their dog, you know, to come to them. And so the dog winds up being a way to communicate with other people, which is actually something we see in American society as well, without the naming.
But basically what you're saying is you would name your dog something like Stole My Lawnmower?
Yeah, exactly. Stole My Lawnmower and you will reap what you sow, right.
All right. Well, we'll talk a bit more about dog names. I certainly want to know how your dog name changed. You got to Finnegan from something else. So I want to finish up the thoughts on dog names, because you collected dogs' names and stories and a lot of them. And I wonder what conclusions you drew from what you discovered.
What I loved about seeing what people are currently naming their dogs and comparing it to historically what we named our dogs is that two things are really happening that I think are profound. One is that we're giving dogs largely human names. So, you know, we've already treated them as members of the family. We do treat them as furry little people, but they're being given names that we would typically only give to other people in previous generations. And I heard from people who have named their dogs after deceased relatives, for instance, the type of honoring that I don't think I would have seen 20 years ago. The other thing is that these names that we give to dogs are often really playful. I mean, they're serious in intent. You want it to suit your dog, but they're also playful, and they sometimes would combine elements of different members of the family, so preferences different people had in the family to come up with the perfect name that kind of represents all members of the family. So I think this is something different than what we do with naming our children, which is usually not silly or playful. It's just, you know, the name we think is appropriate. And both of those things charmed me.
You we were talking about your own dog's name change. How did you get to Finnegan, and what did you have to go through to get to Finnegan?
Right. Finnegan was this little black wisp of a dog we found in a shelter, and we named him Upton, which was, I guess, just a name I had liked a lot. It seemed kind of noble and yet a little bit over serious. And we tried it out for Finnegan for a week or so, and it just didn't suit him. Just didn't suit him at all. He didn't seem like an Upton. So we found that he was more of this slippery, Finnegan-y dog, and that's what we named him. And it was a number of years later that we met another dog who became Upton, and it suits him perfectly.
Okay, so you finally got to use the name Upton.
That's right.
So we get into a number of ethical areas in the book about our relationships with dogs, and ownership is certainly one of them. And so it raises some interesting questions about, are dogs really anything more than property in the eyes of the law?
They're really not anything more than property. And I think that ownership it's somewhat at the heart of the complex issues that get to raise in this book, because although we consider dogs members of the family, in the eyes of the law, dogs are personal property. They're chattel property. You know, their value is only what you paid for them. And that certainly isn't what any of us would estimate the value of our dogs who sit alongside us, who accompany us on vacations, who we're so pleased to see on coming home, who might sleep in your beds. That's not the value we would put on them. So there's a real dissonance in culturally and legally how we deal with dogs today.
So how long did it take for animal cruelty laws to make it onto the books? This is another interesting part about ethics and treatment of animals.
Yeah, it was in the 19th century that, in the early 19th century, that animal cruelty laws started to appear. And this was because people were concerned about the welfare of working animals. So it wasn't dogs right away who were considered to be subjects of this at the time. Early 19th century, dogs were much less owned in homes. But horses, for instance, or cattle who were being worked and driven, people had concerns that they were being overworked and overdriven and that the practices to make them work were cruel. And so the first animal cruelty laws appeared and, you know, Henry Berg, as many people know, developed a more comprehensive animal cruelty law that included domestic animals and pet animals like dogs and cats, and was a really important development. I mean, it can't be underestimated in changing how our culture thought about dealing with dogs. You can't be unnecessarily cruel or kind of willfully maim an animal. Interestingly, though, that isn't really so much for the animal's sake. It is a little bit, but the reason the laws are on the books is because of that ownership issue that you alluded to before. You know, they're our property. So killing of an animal, which is now forbidden in many cases in these with these laws, would be a damage to the owner of that animal. And so that's part of why it's forbidden, which I think is, you know, puts a different light on the issue.
So what kinds of proposals are out there, Alexandra, to confer some higher status for pets?
There certainly are legal thinkers who are thinking about all the ways to make dogs' status be more appropriate to how their place in society today. And for instance, Stephen Wise and the Non-Human Rights Project is very keen to get personhood to animals, various animals. Persons, to the law, things are persons. That includes humans, but is not restricted to humans. You know, a corporation can be a person.
Right.
And persons own property, so everything else is property. So they want to move animals, some animals, to this person status, which would give them the right to lots more rights to be treated well. Other people think that we shouldn't have dogs as property at all. You know, that's another possibility. And other people, David Faber is at Michigan State, has this nice proposal, I think, that we talk about some animals as being living property. And so they might be things that we can own, but we have certain kinds of responsibilities toward their well-being, well more than are outlined in animal cruelty laws. Not just to not be cruel, but to make sure they have a rich and full life.
Alexandra Horowitz is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. And you say, from your own perspective, that we should let dogs be dogs, basically. As you point out, that doesn't mean letting them hump on all the guests, but what does it mean?
I think it means letting them make more choices, do more dog-like things in their lives. I mean, they're really conscribed to humans, right? We developed dogs, we domesticated dogs, and they are at this point really dependent on us for not just their survival, for their home and for their food, and we restrict their mating, but also for just what's going to happen during their day. Their whole day is kind of dictated by us. So letting them have more opportunities to make choices, obviously within the range of things that work in human society, and do things that are doggy, even if that it doesn't seem that polite to us. You know, I've spent a lot of time, as you know, concerned with acknowledging that dogs smell each other. You know, they smell the world. They want to smell us. And even if we think that's impolite, I think it's appropriate for dogs to do so. So I don't want to make any of my guests in my home feel uncomfortable. The dog is not, you know, launching themselves over my guests, but I don't think it's enough to say, like, let this dog smell your hand. Let's, you know, they just need a moment to see who you are. Acknowledging those things is part of letting dogs be dogs.
Well, I must admit, this part of the book was in my head over the weekend. I was walking Churchill and letting him sniff things just a little longer than I normally would have let him.
Wonderful. I mean, I'm sure he appreciated that, frankly.
I hope he did. So I want to give a little interlude here because it's a little later in the book, but about the lab itself. There are no kept dogs there. This is not that kind of a lab. So this is just dogs coming in with their owners, right?
Exactly. I think that's really good to clarify because people imagine that I have dogs in cages sometimes, and of course I don't. I'm studying, you know, normal dog behavior. What's a normal dog in current U.S. society? It's a dog who lives with a person or a family. And so owners volunteer their dogs basically to participate in a study. They come to our lab, which is basically just an empty room in which we'll put various things we want to present to them or a problem we want them to solve or a task we want to set them to. And the dogs participate in that with us. The owner is always present in the room. So the dog doesn't feel anxious. So it's not a lab. It's not a research lab where we're experimenting on dogs in a medical way. We're looking at their behavior.
Okay, we have an email here from Bill in Arcata who wants to know if anything can be learned from the origin of dogs. Is there a trick that makes domestication possible in the first place? That, again, from Bill in Arcata.
Thanks, Bill. It certainly is the case that there's no trick to domestication, but there are certain kinds of animals who are more easily domesticated. And for one thing, many animals are social animals, meaning among their conspecifics, members of their own species, they'll live in social groups. Well, dogs, forebears, are wolves. You know, they live in family packs. How convenient, then, that we also live in family packs, as it were, and dogs can kind of slip into our family. So there are certain things that made dogs more likely to be domesticated than other animals. And then there are also things that actually belie domestication. Most domesticated animals are not predators, right? Most of the animals we keep for food, for instance, or for work, are not predators. But dogs are. So that's unlikely. But it worked out because of early uses of dogs involved hunting with dogs, for instance, or having them retrieve game. And so they became kind of co-conspirators with us in that project.
Oh, that's interesting. We hunted together. I hadn't even thought about the fact that we keep predators as pets, but not as our working animals generally. Wow, that's the...
Right. It's a little bit unusual, but I think that's probably why it worked for early humans.
Alexandra Horowitz is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, the director of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College at Columbia University in New York. Her latest book is called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. It's about us and them. Join us on the Exchange. Your thoughts about dogs and how we treat our dogs and how we should be treating them. Welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's get into the issue of breeding here, because this has certainly caused some medical problems, and a vet you know offered up bulldogs as the breed that has suffered the most. What kinds of issues do they present?
Right. There are many breeds that have been radically changed by 100, 150 years of inbreeding, which is what pure breeding is. And Dr. Addis told me that she thought bulldogs were the ones who'd suffered more than other dogs. I mean, these dogs have been developed to have a very squat body and really large head, too large, in fact, for them to be birthed naturally. They mostly have to be birthed by cesarean section. They are also short-nosed dogs, what we call brachycephalic dogs. So one of the things that we'd like to do in bulldog breeding is shorten their muzzle. They don't have that long wolf-like muzzle. They have more of a kind of primate-shaped face insofar as their eyes are a little more front in the front of their heads and their noses are shorter. But these brachycephalic, short-skulled dogs often have really severe breathing problems because everything else in the face didn't adapt as fast as our shortening of their skull. So all the soft tissue is folded over itself and their respiratory tracts aren't clear. So one of the reasons you see bulldogs often moving slowly and panting and their tongue is out the side of their mouth is not because they've been exerting themselves, just because they've been moving at all, but they're breathing through a straw.
Oh, wow. So they're almost asthmatic or something.
Yeah, we've bred them to already have this health problem built in. So that's obviously a problem with breeding dogs for appearance as as we have been doing for the last 150 years.
And you mentioned a show-winning Pekingese who had to be packed in ice during the shows. What was going on there?
Yeah, this was a dog who won Crufts a number of years back, the Kennel Club show in the UK. And this dog had such severe breathing problems, shorter respiratory pathway, same thing, brachycephalic breed, and also, has this elaborate hair and was heavily groomed, that just walking around the ring, the dog got well overheated and had to be put on an ice pack while they were delivering his best of show Meadows. So the irony in that is that what is considered the best dog of all the breeds in this particular show was a dog who was clearly straining just to do ordinary daily activities.
Wow. Interesting, though, in the history you give of purebred dog breeding, and you mentioned the 19th century is where it really picked up speed. But, you know, the point you make in there, too, is that purebreds really do have a lot of mutt ancestors. What we're doing is it's the inbreeding that produces this greater purity of breed and quotes around purity.
Right, exactly. Keep those quotes, because that was the idea with early development of breed lines, was that they wanted to distinguish the sort of most beautiful, best examples of types of dogs. You know, dogs certainly looked different ways. It wasn't that they were all one uniform look, but they weren't assiduously bred together with just other dogs who looked that way. They were bred for what they could do well, you know, or they were bred with whoever they ran across. So they pulled out dogs that looked a certain way, and they started to breed them just with other dogs who looked the way they thought was appropriate for that breed line, and gave them a breed name. But yeah, in their history, of course, they're all mutts, right? Way back, going way back. There's no breed that can truly trace its lineage, despite what some breed standards might say. You know, 2,000 years ago, there were dogs who looked like mastiffs and looked like kind of greyhound dogs, but they weren't inbred together up until today. It was only recently that we started doing that.
What would you like to see about breeding? Would you want to see it go away completely?
I think breeding has to be for health, not for looks. I think we have to let go of the idea that we can just have a dog that's designed just as we like, just like a car, because it's not healthy for the dogs. So frankly, yeah, it should change. And that could be done by keeping a lot of the ways dogs look that we like, by just mixing them with other dogs. So some of these new designer dogs, actually, who are two purebreds mixed together, you know, that's a dog that's more likely to be healthy. They're not inbred. And if you kept mixing them, then that would even, you know, that would increase the health of the dogs. And I think that's a better way forward for dogs, yes.
Now, what about what we do generally when we get our dogs, which is to have them spayed or neutered? And you have some thoughts on this as well in the book.
Interestingly, spaying and neutering dogs is mandatory in many states for dogs who are adopted from shelters. And those are actually not usually the purebred dogs, although there are purebred dogs that wind up at shelters. Purebred dogs kind of can keep, you know, a breeder can keep making new puppies. They're allowed to because they're breeders. So the spaying and neutering is trying to solve the problem of overpopulation of unwanted dogs. And that was a very bad problem in the 70s and 80s and still is a problem insofar as there's still millions of dogs and cats euthanized every year because they don't have homes. I think it's just something that we should look at, the fact that we're spaying, you know, a new dog or neutering a new dog to try to solve a problem which we as humans made, which is that we made too many dogs and we let them go. You know, we lose dogs. We let them have puppies and didn't find places for the puppies. So it seems like a human problem that we're trying to solve by spaying the next generation. And it hasn't solved the problem, that's for sure.
Let's move into the realm of talking to our dogs. This is not exactly like the way we talk to our children, but it sounds like from your research, they occupy a similar space in our brains.
Yeah, we do talk in some ways to dogs the way we talk to our children. I'm saying this as somebody who has essentially eavesdropped on people wherever I go over the last several years. talking to their dogs, you know, when I pass by or at the dog park or somebody who comes to my lab. We use, you know, shorter words, reduce vocabulary when we talk to our dogs. We might use a higher pitched voice. But what I found is that we're actually talking to the dogs in this kind of intimate way. Like we're letting them in on a conversation that we're having with ourselves a little bit. And so in some ways it represents the singular nature of the bond between dog and person, that we're always talking to them as though they're, you know, like always in on the conversation with us in our heads.
So now this is really interesting. You mentioned the Yurok people from our part of the country who did not name or talk to dogs. Why?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I can't imagine not talking to my dogs. I actually talk to my dogs all the time. But there are some peoples and maybe some people as well who feel like to talk to dogs is risking that they might talk back, and that would somehow, you know, upset the natural order of the world. So although they very much respected dogs and named they didn't name their dogs, actually, but respected them and would give them a ceremonial burial when they died and worked with them. They were definitely part of the community. They didn't talk to them. That's quite unlike most of the rest of us who are always asking things of our dogs, you know, telling them, we talked about this before, scolding them for things that they should or shouldn't have understood that they're supposed to do. So really different than most of how we deal with dogs.
There's a funny chapter in here about observing your dogs on a Thursday evening, and it sounds like even for what you've learned about the creatures, you can still be surprised by them, even your own.
I love wearing two hats of being a scientist who looks at dogs in a certain way in a lab in very kind of constrained, controlled setting, but also living with dogs myself at home. You know, who gives me my ideas about what to study? Well, it's my dogs. It's by looking at dogs in the natural world, and that includes those at home. So I do go through an exercise of kind of playing with how you create a hypothesis about what's happening and revise that hypothesis with new evidence, which is, I think, something that we all, as people who live with dogs, have a tendency to want to do. Say, why are they doing that? And come up with ideas about it. And as a scientist, the only difference is that I also get to try to test one of those ideas.
So is there one finding about dogs, Alexandra, that if you've confirmed through experiments to be true that has just blown your mind?
I mean, I think that dogs' recognition of themselves and others exclusively through smell, I think that is amazing to me, because partly because we don't live in that world at all, right? We frankly try to avoid smelling each other, right? And we don't want our own odor and natural body odor to be detectable by others. So the whole notion that the pleasure they get of seeing their friends is to go up and smell them deeply, and that they recognize us by smell is something we've also studied. If you take our odor from, we wear a t-shirt and then leave it, they recognize that as our smell and they can distinguish it from other smells. I think that's just really cool.
So yeah, the whole thing with the way the nose works, much more so than other sense organs. I mean, for example, with our dog, who's one of those shaggy terrier kinds of guys, his hair tends to grow up in front of his eyes, and he makes it really difficult for us to get it under control. So, but it's not really important to him. I mean, the eyes are just sort of, you know, an adjunct, like, you know, 20% of the job, if that, it seems like.
They certainly use their eyes, right? And in fact, they'll use their eyes to validate what they smell, right? So you might sometimes see a dog sniffing something on the ground and then look up and around. And what they're doing is smelling that somebody has been by and maybe has marked that area or just left their smell in a footprint. And then they're looking up to see which way that person goes. So they do use their eyes, but it's, yeah, they're like the wingman. They're not necessarily leading the perceptual experience like eyes are for us. We see the world first and they smell it first.
Are the eyes even as important as the ears? I mean, given the size of the ears, I mean, when you think about how they're how they're wired, basically, with nose and large ears. It seems like the eyes are kind of in third place.
It's hard for me to say. I don't think I could really prioritize what it is. It might be different for different dogs. You know, some have a lot of pendulous ears, the ears that sort of fold over, that I find that very sweet. That's something that happens in domestication. You know, wolves usually have upright ears. That actually makes it harder for them to hear a little bit, if you can imagine, just because, you know, the air doesn't get right into the ear canal as easily as it would if the ear was upright. So it's hard to say, you know, and my dogs aren't telling me.
Darn it. Well, let's move on and talk about the industry of dog stuff. How big an economy is that?
It's a multi-billion dollar industry of things that we can buy for our dogs. And I find this fascinating. And in the book, I get to explore a little bit the history of where it began. You know, into pet stores and pet shops began with the rise of pure breeding, when suddenly there was an influx of people getting fancy new dogs, and dogs were becoming more owned and less just generally on the street and around and in the houses. And then we started wanting to buy things for our dogs to show our love for them, just the way that we buy things for ourselves or for others. And that industry, surprisingly, you know, looks sort of similar in the early 1900s as it does today. There were collars and leashes and ways to muzzle your dogs or restrain them. There were a whole range of toys, just like we have now. And there, and dog food was invented, too, in the 19th century, where kibble, you know, first appeared probably in 1850. And we're still giving dogs kibble today. So I think it's interesting that there is such a large industry trying to capture our affection for our dogs. And also that it, in some ways, is not that changed from 100, 150 years ago.
Is there anything of the dog provisions that you find just plain silly?
Oh, so much of dog provisions is silly currently. You know, I mean, obviously they're for the people, right? But I love to let my dog wander through a pet store and kind of choose what he's going to take home. But most of the things, you know, are the stuffed animals of all sorts that you can pull apart the innards of. I think there's something that's appropriate about that, insofar as it invokes that they used to be hunting animals, wolves, that would kill and pull out the innards of their prey. But does it matter if it's if it's a badger or a cat or a frog, or the dogs don't care about most of those things. That's all tailored for human eyes. So I find things like costumes that are also tailored for humans more than for dogs, you know, pretty silly.
Yeah,
but dogs put up with it, that's for sure.
They do. They don't look too embarrassed, but we can talk about dog looks in a moment. One thing I did want to point out, that I'm glad you brought up the stuffed animals thing, because we've learned almost the hard way that don't let your dog get a hold of a stuffed animal made for a kid, because there could be stuff in there that can cause problems for the dog.
Precisely. And, you know, those two markets are overlap in stuffed animals. So there, we definitely have had that experience of lots of dogs who got a hold of the child stuffed animal, and that's tragic for both dog and child.
Right. I mean, we found a couple of places where arms attached and things like that, that little metal things that could really do the dog some damage,
right,
if they swallowed it, stuff like that. So we have an email here going back to the smell issue from Jeff in Ashland, who says, are you aware that dogs smell in stereo?
Yes. Isn't that a fabulous fact? The nostrils can move independently. And so they're actually grabbing different odor spaces from the world on both sides. And it is just, I imagine, like seeing in stereo, where we can not only see something, but kind of see where it is in space relative to other things. With smell, that means that if they're smelling somebody approaching or someone moving away, they might know which way that person or dog or other animal is going, which is fantastic.
Wow, that is amazing. Okay, this one's coming, that one's going. I can tell just by nose alone. That's amazing.
Something we don't think about, you know, that's what I think is most profound about that, is that we also have noses, but we don't use them that way.
Right. Yeah. I remember from our original conversation several years ago that the dogs just, it's way beyond what we're capable of smelling. And then since that time, we talked to somebody last year who runs a service where they help people find from homes that have burned down the ashes that already existed of their loved ones. Dogs can find those ashes within other ashes.
Well, yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I hadn't even heard about that application, basically, of the dog nose. But insofar as everything has a smell, and smells are distinct, mm-hmm. you know, just like they're visually distinct, I guess I can understand how that would happen. That's really neat.
Yeah, it really is. It's so there's a whole chapter here on Does My Dog Love Me? And so break it to us gently, Alexandra.
You know, scientists, I'm often asked as a scientist to confirm, I guess, that you know, someone's dog really loves them. And I think people ask me this because, you know, they're just hoping that science verifies what they already instinctively know. And what I'm kind of disappointed to tell them is that we just can't prove, science can't prove that. And if somebody tells you, you know, we know exactly how a dog feels, I would say they're overreaching, you know, they're overstepping what science can prove. But everything about a dog's affectionate, loving greeting of a person who they know when that person's been gone reeks of love. You know, I mean, I think it's perfectly fine to talk about love as an emotion that dogs feel, and since we're a member of their family, feel toward us. What exactly it feels like to be that dog, that's the thing I can't say, you know, and I don't know that we'll ever develop a science that can say that for sure. That's going to remain a little bit of a mystery.
Do we swap some bonding hormones, some oxytocin, with dogs?
It's certainly the case that research has shown that in petting dogs or in gazing into dogs' eyes, kind of looking at dogs the way we might do, you might even look at a dog you just met or a dog that you're familiar with, both dog and person, in some cases, have spikes of their oxytocin levels, yes. So it's not exactly contagious, but some behavior that we're doing together, some activity that we're in together, whether it's touching or just looking at each other, seems to make us both feel good. And oxytocin is at least one hormone that's responsible for that.
All right. So a couple questions before we go. We got about a minute left. The guilty look, is it real guilt?
What we have found is that guilty look is an expression of feeling that someone is about to scold you and wanting them not to scold you. So it's a kind of submissive or appeasement look. But I can't say for sure, just like I can't say what it feels like, you know, to be a dog loving a human if they're feeling guilt. It looks like that look is more about just not wanting to be scolded.
And do we know what dogs are doing when they do that head tilting thing?
Oh, there we do. And that has to do with stereo as well. They're just trying to they're trying to hear better, right? And by moving their heads, they can get a little bit different sound. So they'll do it when you say something and they're sort of anticipating what's going to happen next. And, you know, it's cute and we respond to it. So it probably gets reinforced just as a cute look.
Do your dogs still have great power over you? Can they do the big eyes things and all that stuff to gain command of a situation?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I follow them. That's for sure.
Right. Always a fun conversation when we have Alexandra Horowitz on from the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College at Columbia University. Her latest book is called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. Alexandra, thank you once again.
Always a pleasure, Jeffrey. Thank you.
All right. Take care.